This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week we're going to complete the two-part episode with our friend Steve Cohen and his chamber magic, but this week we're going to be talking more about Max Mellini and the book that he has completed, actually. It's just a matter of time of getting the book actually delivered. And this is an interesting episode, which he tells some of the stories that are from the book. We also are going to be picking up this episode where we left off the last time and also catching up a little bit, a few sentences before, so you don't have to necessarily have heard last week's episode because there are some things we talk about this week that are completely separate from what we discussed there last week. But it does kind of help if you had heard last week's episode, number 650, that would complement this one and would flow nicely into this episode 651. So if you've not heard that one, I would suggest obviously going back into the archives and listening to all of them. But you could also just listen to then to 650 and get caught up as well. But this would be one, if you are interested in history and learning more about Max Mellini, I would highly recommend that you get on his list to, perhaps he's going to have a pre-order list. I don't know. But anyhow, once the book becomes available, I think you should get a copy. I plan to do that. I'm sure it's going to be just a phenomenal book. He's spent a lot of time and years in writing and editing this book and putting it all together because, well, I'm not going to get into all this. He's going to discuss this and you'll hear a lot more of this. I also want to recommend one more thing, and that is to make sure if you have not yet subscribed to the YouTube channel, you can always do that. Just go to youtube.com/Texas Magician and subscribe. From time to time, we have some, well, we always have the videos. I say always. We've been doing this for quite some time in which we've been posting these audio podcasts on YouTube. But when we have the opportunity, when we are actually talking with someone and we do have the video camera on, then we post those. So from time to time, there are some video YouTube podcasts that have been released that you can actually listen to the podcast and get some additional content by watching some of the things that we're talking about or holding up and explaining during the episode. So anyhow, I would recommend again doing that. And also, if you have not yet subscribed to the Pod Letter, please do that. If you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there, whenever you go to the website, there should be a pop-up that would say subscribe to our Pod Letter. And that's just a weekly Pod Letter or a newsletter, basically. I call it a Pod Letter. I coined that phrase, and which would give you an opportunity to learn not only who we have coming up this week, but who's going to be coming up the following week. And also a suggestion from the archives of a podcast you may have missed or should listen to again. Well, I appreciate you coming back this week for the next podcast that we have, another 50 that are going to be, this is 651. We're going to be carrying on to number 700, and who knows what number 700 will bring and who will be that celebrity magician who will be our guest for that one. But this is, again, a milestone, 650 last week with Steve Cohen, and we continue into this week with episode 651. So please welcome my guest, Mr. Steve Cohen, here on The Magic Word.
But the Waldorf, I was fortunate. The Waldorf did have a name value.
Okay.
Around the world. I can say to anyone, I'm the magician at the Waldorf Astoria, and instantly, boom, it was my calling card.
Well, a lot of times people, I do, think of a Waldorf salad, you know.
Which was created by, of course, Oscar Turkey.
What?
Oscar Turkey at the Waldorf Astoria.
Oscar, his real name.
That's his name, Oscar Turkey, who actually met Max Mellini. And there's an article that was in, I think, 1912 or 1913 or so, where Max Mellini was performing at the Waldorf in New York. And this was written up in gossip column, because everyone knew Oscar of the Waldorf. That was his nickname. Oh. He invented not only the Waldorf salad, but also red velvet cake. He invented Thousand Island dressing, Eggs Benedict. And
he was a head chef, I guess.
No, he wasn't even a chef. He was the maitre d' of the hotel.
I'll be.
But he had, you know, this panache in the kitchen. You know, sure. He had some ideas of wild combinations. So, long story short, though, in this article that I found about Max Mellini performing for Oscar of the Waldorf, Oscar said, "What kind of breakfast would you like?" They're both Eastern Europeans, so they had this accent. Yeah. You know, what kind of breakfast would you like? And Mellini's like, "I want some eggs." And so then he reached into Oscar's mouth, allegedly, and pulled out an egg.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's the story that was published in the papers.
Uh-huh.
And Oscar then said some quip, something like, you know, if that's how you make eggs, you'll never be hungry, you know, some silly quip. But Mellini was always in the papers. I've been really fortunate in researching this new book. That's like I mentioned, you know, it's 550 pages.
Holy moly.
You know, in researching, I went through thousands of newspaper articles in the newspaper archives that are now available to us on the internet.
The Conjurer's Art Society?
Or? Oh, well, I mean, definitely through, you know, Kalusha's library helped a lot with Ask Alexander from Conjuring Arts Research Center. That definitely helped, but that was not public-facing articles. Those are only magician-facing articles.
Okay, gotcha.
I went through thousands of articles that were written in the mainstream press.
Library of Congress kind of?
Library of Congress was just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, goodness.
I've read articles from, you know, British newspapers, Australian newspapers, German newspapers, Yiddish newspapers, which I had to have translated into English, Japanese newspapers, which I personally translated myself because Mellini went to Japan 8 times.
Huh.
And so... When you combine all these outward facing articles, you get a real feel for who Mellini was, because you're seeing how he affected reporters who were very, you know, observant people, right?
Sure.
And so if he was going to give an interview in his hotel room for a reporter, you know that reporter was watching everything very closely, so they would write it up in immense detail. And I've got some great stories about that. In any event, going back to the Waldorf. So, you know, I was at the Waldorf for 16 and a half years. I did 3,750 shows there.
Okay.
Okay. And when you think about it, that's a lot of performing, right?
Yeah.
Every show is an hour
and a half. I
don't
have to think
long.
About it. I can, it is.
And then I moved the show to the Palace and did another 1,250 shows there. And that was then the 5,000 show mark.
Oh.
And we had this idea to contact the mayor and invite the mayor to that 5,000th show.
Of New York.
Mayor of New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio. And he didn't come, but he issued a proclamation in the city of New York calling it Chamber Magic Day.
How cool
is
that?
In the city of New York on October 4th. And
of
2017,
okay.
I think it was. And I have that proclamation on my wall at home, calling it Chamber Magic Day. It's very long. It's a beautifully written, you know, proclamation. And I always tell people that that was the best proclamation that de Blasio ever made.
I think
because he's not a very popular mayor.
Exactly.
So, you know, so the shows then exceeded 5,000 performances, and you go to the 6,000 performances. Now it's beyond 6,000 performances. And then you say, well, what keeps you going? Right, like, why would you want to continue? I mean, people ask Copperfield the same question: what keeps you going? He's done more than, you know, more than 20,000, 30,000.
Siegfried and Roy went to the very end,
exactly. And you know, at this point, I'm not doing it for the fame. I mean, I have a medium amount of fame. I'm a legend in my own mind, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, I walk down the street in New York City, and people stop me every day.
Yeah.
And I always have with me a deck of Tycoon playing cards, the cards that I make with...
That's your own card.
With Theory 11.
Yeah.
And I give them out to people.
Oh, nice.
And I always tell people... And I get stopped in the subway, because I just go around the city like
the whole deck
else.
Of cards, or do you take out
the whole
and sign
deck.
Them?
Yeah, I get the whole deck.
Okay.
Yeah. I say, here, these are the cards I used in my show last night, and I give it to them. And I also made these beautiful silver dollar-sized coins that were minted for the 20th anniversary of my show. And I give those out to people, or I'll magically appear, you know, produce that from my hand, give that to them. And people, you know, they really appreciate the connection. And I love that. Like, for me, that's even more important than the show, is just being able to stop on the street, talk to people.
And make their day.
And you know,
and,
exactly.
And make a story that they will remember.
They'll be able to tell other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what I try to do with the show now, is make as much of the show about... is to elicit people's reaction, is that it happened to me.
Yeah.
So if people can walk away from that show saying it happened to me, then they're going to start talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's magic that happened in the magician's hands, like we talk about with Eugene, and we're saying it's the adventures of the props in the magician's hands.
Right.
You know, of course, at the moment, it's magnificent, and people are fooled and they're baffled. They're like, wow, that was great. But if it happened to me, that's the thing they're going to take home with them. And so what if everything in my show, what if every trick, what if every routine was made with that parameter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in addition, what if every trick was a closer? Right. So now right. you're thinking, okay, I'm not going to do filler.
Right.
You're making a new kind of paradigm for what your show is. It's not just about, I need to throw in my egg bag routine, my linking rings, and my build a lemon.
And build a show. You're
right.
actually.
Now it's like, okay, I want everything to be a closer. I want everything to be a
closer. What a concept.
And so then you have to build some texture in and amongst that. Mm-hmm. It's been a real struggle, but you know, I now have a show that I feel accomplishes that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I'm not doing exactly the same show I did 20 years ago, but it's evolved. And there are still definitely things that you saw when I did the show in
right.
whatever that was, 2007, 2008.
It
I don't even
was
know
about,
it
was. Yeah, 15 years ago
right?
or so.
Mm-hmm. But there's all new sections that now I think they add new texture to the show. And what I mean by texture is, you know, if you're going to do a torn and restored bill followed by a torn and restored newspaper, followed by a torn and restored card, you know, yes, you did three different tricks, but you have this one power that you can only just, that's your power. You can put things back together
uh-huh,
again.
Uh-huh.
The same thing with linking rings. Like I did the linking finger rings, then I did the linking hangers, coat hangers, and I did the linking, playing cards, you know, whatever it is.
So it's important to throw in some mentalism then also, obviously,
well,
with magic.
Nothing's thrown in, you know, so it's...
Okay, I don't mean to use the term lightly, thrown in.
Everything
I mean
is, you know,
scripted
it's
properly.
Really, it's really, you know, it's pretty strategic. And
mm-hmm.
so you know, Mark Levy, like I mentioned, is a really smart guy. He's my best friend. He's also my co-writer of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, having worked with Banachek and, you know, working with other great magicians and mentalists, it really helps to have someone who thinks at a high level who is also a great team player.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark has been that for me. He's an unbelievable supporter, cheerleader, and inspiration to everything I've done. And so what he said to me is, like, you can't have two effects that are anything this like I mentioned before that are the same power. So what are your powers? We have to define what are the powers of my character, the Millionaire's Magician.
Correct.
I can't do everything. I can only do certain things. So one of my powers I don't have is I don't have the power of precognition
clairvoyance.
No, not clairvoyance. I don't have the power of
psychokinesis.
Prediction.
Okay.
So there are no prediction tricks in my show. I don't like prediction tricks.
Okay.
I don't have any affinity for that, and if I see another magician or mentalist do prediction effects, it usually makes me want to leave the room because mm-hmm. I just don't like that kind of effect. It's not one of my powers, and that was one of the things that Mark and I always joked about mm-hmm. was that my saying, "Oh, that's not one of my powers," and it's a way for us to say that the Millionaire's Magician is a character
sure.
that we're writing to.
Yes,
and
what would the Millionaire's Magician do?
Correct, and that was a phrase that we often used.
Mm-hmm.
What would the Millionaire's Magician do, and wouldn't he do? And we always talked about him in a third person. Now, I've grown into the character.
Like, yes.
I've really become the Millionaire's Magician. And my life has, you know, benefited from that. And in many ways, now I can hobnob with my clients and feel very at ease because, you know, I can afford the things they can afford more
yeah.
or less. You know, I'm not a billionaire. But, you know, we can go on vacationing in the same spots and
mm-hmm.
you know, enjoy the same, you know, standard of living in many ways. I don't feel inferior. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of a big thing for me. But at the same time, you know, trying to create a show that has these different – I'm going back to a couple of steps here. We have to have effects that are different to each other and then also build in a kind of a cascading way. So when you're finally at the end of the show, there's this kind of euphoria, right?
Uh-huh.
That's what you're trying to aim towards. So I kind of step back to the previous conversation. But is, you know, the hardest thing for me now is to take something out of the show and put something in because they're not really just slots that
not
you can
plug
slide
and play
out
kind of a thing.
And,
yeah.
and insert. You know, one builds upon the next. And I've become very comfortable with that. I'm very aware when I'm performing of my feet. And this is kind of an odd little aside, but I try to minimize the
rocking back and forth, or
not just the rocking back and forth, but even the movement on the stage. Like I try to minimize the amount of walking.
OK. Okay. I know Juan Tamaris talks about that. About
Juan, yeah, because Juan would always talk about, like, don't put your feet side by side in like an equal sign.
Right.
Then you're going to just tilt back and forth to the left and to the right, like you're going to get seasick and make your audience feel seasick.
Yeah.
But like I was actually really lucky. And you know the director Guillermo del Toro?
I do, yes.
Yeah, so Guillermo's been to my show three times. And and then the last show he came, which was in November of 2019, and he said, Steve, would you like to be would you like to have a cameo in my next movie? And I said, oh my God, I don't even have to think about it. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
So I went up to Buffalo in February of 2020 for his next film, which is called Nightmare Alley. And I got a chance to act in two scenes with Bradley Cooper, just the two of us.
Okay. Do you have a speaking part?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it may get cut. You know, he said to me it's an uncuttable cameo because it's an important moment in the film. But, you know, I haven't talked to him since then. So so it might be cut, but I'm hoping it stays in. But regardless of whether it stays in or not, I learned so much from my 3 days in Buffalo. And the thing I learned the most was about the stage picture and how you can affect it in the most subtle ways. And one of the things he taught me was he said, I want you to do the same scene. We're going to take several takes of you and Bradley. First couple of scenes, we're going to do you leaning on your front foot. And then we'll do the same exact scene multiple times with you leaning on your back foot. And I'm thinking, how can that possibly make a difference?
Yeah.
That can't make any difference. Sure enough, I saw the daily screens.
The Russians.
And and it is like night and day. Like one of them, it looked like this. One of them looked like that. It was like two entirely different fields.
Delivering the same line?
Delivering the same line.
Delivering it in a different way? Did you feel
it? I didn't deliver it any differently as far as I could. It's just the screenshot. It's a screen.
It's whether you're leaning into the camera or leaning
back. It was just... I mean, I'm going to stand up now just so you can see, Scott.
Okay.
But I'm like, so you're Bradley Cooper. I'm here.
Okay.
And part of it, I'm leaning like this. And part of it, I'm leaning like this. That's a difference of maybe 3 inches of where my head is in the frame.
In the frame, right.
But that, you know, we don't think of it in that minutia. But remember, when you're on a screen, on a motion picture screen, that 3 inches is more like a foot or maybe 3 feet, you know, because everything gets expanded during the projection. But I thought, how can I take that lesson and apply it to my magic show?
Mm-hmm.
Right. It means I have to be aware of what the stage picture is, not the screen, but the stage picture. And even just leaning one way or the other can actually change people's experience of how you're actually presenting it. And, you know, another thing I like to do is, again, this is talking about foot placement. I like to start on the right side of the stage during the beginning of the show and end on the stage left, on the left side of the stage. So because from the audience's point of view, I'm moving from left to right, which is a very comfortable...
Which is why you read
left to right. Well, in English, in most Western languages, we read from left to right. So it's a very normal or kind of natural way of progression, from left to right. If you go from right to left, it feels like you're going against the grain.
That's why in stage shows, usually the MC and most acts will enter stage right that way because people, and they will exit stage
correct.
Left. Yeah.
Correct. That's natural. And so, so I've done that also with the show. Like I've learned just, you know, okay, start, if I'm going to do any effects, I'm going to start on this side, on the right, then move to, for me, my right, my middle, my left. But for the audience, it's natural for their left and et cetera. So, you know, again, I think that these types of tips are really helpful, and especially, you know, I even wrote about this in the Mellini book because, you know, the Mellini book is not just a history lesson. I mean, of course, there's a big chunk where I talk about his life and all of the experiences he's had and a whole timeline of the thousands of performances he's given, essays that were spoken by his son, with all of his escapades. It's really pretty incredible.
And but there'll be tricks in there also?
But that's the other part, is that there's 100 magic tricks that Mellini performed.
Yeah, because there's only the one book I can think of that's a hardback book on Mellini's tricks right now.
Yeah, but it was written by Louis Ganson with notes by Vernon. And it was very skimpy, and it was only 104 pages. And it was mostly Vernon's guesswork and he never was close with Mellini.
Oh.
Mellini, in a way, despised Vernon. There's many...
Why?
A lot of evidence. It's kind of a longer story, but there were times when... Once, for example, Vernon was doing the blindfolded card stab.
Okay.
At a hotel in Florida, and Mulaney had heard that Vernon was in Florida doing his trick.
Yeah, he did his stab.
And
right.
And Mulaney was in Florida at the same time, and he said, "Vernon, don't do my trick." And Vernon spoke back to him. He says, "It's not your trick. If you look in Erdnase, you could see it's in Erdnase. It's the divining rod. Mm-hmm. You know, blindfold card, one stab." He says, "Yes." Mulaney says, "But it's just one card. I do it with multiple cards. That's my trick." Okay. And so he said, "Here, instead, I'll give you a different trick to perform." And the trick that he taught Vernon instead was this stupid trick. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Okay.
Where he says, "Take a potato and stick the potato underneath your shirt, and then stick a pin, like a long needle, into the potato so the needle is sticking out."
Okay.
"And at the other end of the pin, attach a bead of wax."
Okay.
"And now you've got a pin that's sticking straight out from your shirt.
With the wax on it." Okay.
"With a piece of wax on it." And then he said, "Borrow a coin, Vernon, stick it to the wax, and then make it look like it's floating in front of your body."
Okay, that is stupid.
Okay, it's the stupidest trick in the world.
Yeah.
And then and Vernon's like, "But how do you get the wax on there?" And then Mulaney walks away and says, "You figure it out."
Okay.
Right. So you know, the funny thing is that I don't know if that was the impetus of why he didn't want Vernon. Why he didn't like Vernon, but Mulaney was much closer with Charlie Miller,
Charlie ever stay? I mean, you know, Charlie was what they call the perennial house guest.
That's true.
He stayed with people. I guess he never stayed with
Mulaney when he was traveling was, you know, he was all over. He stayed in hotels.
He didn't have a place to stay too either.
But when he was living in Los Angeles, he had his own little apartment. I think it was called the Langham Apartments. Not too far from the hotel where he was performing at. And so I've modeled much of my career after Hofstetter's show, but Mulaney's MO, which is to perform for wealthy people in hotels.
Yeah.
And the other thing that many magicians make the error of thinking is that we all think that Mulaney only performed for wealthy people in their private, you know, homes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we all assume, that he performed in drawing rooms, etc. But during my research, I found hundreds, going up to close to over 1,000 shows that were for the public, that were not for small audiences, but for 300 people at a time, 400 people at a time. In fact, when he was performing in Honolulu, he did a show for 2,000 people.
Holy moly.
Okay? If you can believe it.
That is hard to believe.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking back also about the kind of...
This is in 1941.
Okay, they had good speaker systems.
They had speaker systems, okay. Then, yes.
Yeah, but still, 2,000 people. Mulaney, I assume, doing a card stab and...
Yeah, he did...
Ice
he,
production, maybe, or whatever.
No, that's the other thing about the ice production, and I'm going to talk about the ice production when I do my talk here at Magi Fest. But there's a whole section about the brick from the hat, which I've kind of become known for. I've been doing that, you know, I produced enough bricks to build a house, a pretty nice-sized house.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, Mulaney is known for the block of ice production, and I don't think that he did it more than a handful of times. Maybe 10, maybe 20 times. But, you know, you don't have to win the Nobel Prize more than once to be called a Nobel laureate, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you win it once, and then for the rest of your life, that's part of your legacy.
Is that kind of like the Berglas effect?
In many cases, yeah. But I mean, David Berglas performed it for me, so I know that he can do it.
Okay. I'm sorry, I got you.
Yeah. It's perfectly fine. But I don't think that Mulaney did the block of ice production more as often as we think he did.
Mm.
He only had to do it a handful of times, and then the legend starts to grow, right? And people say, "Oh, he produced." But Mulaney produced all sorts of things. He produced a block of ice. He produced a coconut. He produced an alarm clock. Famously, he stole an alarm clock from Bess Houdini's office when he was visiting Bess Houdini in California. Threw it underneath his jacket, and then later on produced it. As he lifted up the hat, he triggered the bell and the little hammer that goes off between them. So as he's picking up the hat, the bell is ringing on the alarm clock.
Gotcha.
You know, he produced all sorts of things. Another famous one which didn't pan out was he swiped a couple of pork chops. Do you know this story?
No, I don't.
So he swiped a couple of pork chops when he was at the Larson's house at Brookledge.
Brookledge, yeah.
And he intended to produce them. He just threw it under his vest. He used to vest everything. You know,
okay.
That was a popular accoutrement for him at the time. He was like a Toppin, basically. But he was sticking underneath his vest, and he had this fresh, uncooked pork chop that he was eventually going to produce from under his hat like he produced all this other stuff.
Okay.
But he realized he couldn't walk around with it all night, so he went into the library and he stuck it behind one of the books, intending to produce it later on. Mm-hmm. But Mellini was also an alcoholic, so he got pretty tipsy. He got loaded. And he forgot to do that trick. Mm-hmm. And so he left, and like about a week or two goes by, and the maid is cleaning up and like smells this really awful stench in the library at Brookledge and couldn't figure out what the hell was going on, where this was.
Yeah.
And eventually was pulling away the books and dusting the books off and found this rotting pork chop with the flies flying around
it. Like, how did this get here and why?
Yeah, so that's one great story about a pork chop with Max Mellini. But the second one that was even better, that his son told at the history conference.
At the L.A.?
The L.A. History Conference, yeah. This is in 1989. So Ozzie Mellini came and gave this great talk. I wasn't there, but I've heard a transcript of it and then transcribed it myself, and it's going to be in the book.
Okay.
See, Mellini wrote, I'll tell you about the pork chop story in a second, but Mellini wrote an autobiography, which is called Only Mellini. And, Just Mellini, Just Mellini. And that manuscript has gone missing. But the people who apparently have read it, or had read it, said it was horrific to read because Mellini's English was like listening to a kosher butcher talk.
Okay.
He butchered the language.
And his writing was worse.
And his writing was equivalent to his speaking.
Speaking,
so he spoke, he put the, he always put the emphasis on the wrong word, and it was always the wrong word in the first place.
Emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Correct. So he butchered the English language. And so trying to read that manuscript would not have really been very helpful. Fortunately, at this 1989 history conference in L.A., Ozzie Mellini, who was his son, who spoke perfectly good English. He was born in Manila, Philippines, but he traveled with his father and grew up in military schools here in the U.S. He gave a great talk, very eloquent, with all the stories that I bet you Mellini would have had in his own autobiography, but told well.
Okay.
So one of the stories that Ozzie Mellini told was about when they were in the Philippines, and Mellini, who was a Jew, like myself, was being stung by one of his clients. And the clients said, "Hey, we're gonna fool Mellini.
Cheat this guy.
And we're gonna get Mellini. We're gonna fool the magician. We'll trick the magician."
Were they trying to cheat him out of money?
No. We'll startle him.
Okay, I got you.
And we'll startle him by at dinner time serving him a head of a pig.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
and as a Jew, that's not...
And of course, if you're Jewish, you can't eat pork. That's just against the religion.
Right.
So no bacon, no ham, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so here's what happens. So he gets that story leaked to him somehow, like maybe the chef or someone. Mm-hmm. So he finds out in advance that these people who he was invited to him to dinner were going to play a trick on him. So he prepares a counter trick.
Okay.
And he has his counter trick, which I'll tell you, hidden underneath his own napkin.
Okay.
So they come to the main course, and the waiters place his plate down, and they lift up that silver tray, and there's a pig head in front of him. And Mellini, in kind of a mock prayer, he says, "Oh, my lord, I'm a good Jew. I can't eat this. What can I possibly do? I'm a good Jew. Please forgive me." And he said, I can't even look at this. And so he lifts up his napkin, and he does this switcheroo.
Okay.
And when he whips away the napkin, now there's two turkey drumsticks sitting there.
And the pig's head's gone.
And the pig head is gone.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, "Oh, my God, Mellini is a genius." And they got he got the best of us. How could we possibly? Because he was great at planning these things out. He always liked to plan ahead. So now the question is, what happened to that pig head?
Sure.
Well, he didn't sleeve it, he didn't invest it. He didn't smuggle it out.
I'm guessing he had something kind of like...
Listen, about a week later, he got a telegram letter and it was from the owner of that home. Uh-huh. Said, "Mr. Molina, you have to tell us, what did you do with that pig head? Our living room is starting to stink, and you have to tell us where it went." It turns out that he had planted it in the folds of the flag, the Filipino flag.
Uh-huh.
And there was a Philippines flag and an American flag there, and he kind of just figured out a way to kind of unwrap it inside the flag. Mm-hmm. And it was stayed there, which is very unpatriotic, but he had to figure out a way to unload it, and that was his best way. So I don't know if he ever told them where it was hidden, but I just think that's the greatest story ever.
That is good. There were so many stories, I imagine, about Molina. I'm wondering how many of them actually became legends that were untrue.
The card stab?
Hit the card stab, saying they can say that was done by Molina.
I tried to track down that table. The story has been told in many by different magicians. Like, Paul Daniels told the story about how it took place in the UK, and then there were stories of Ricky Jay talking about how it took place in San Francisco at the St. Francis Hotel, and another story I'd heard happened in New York. I mean, so people kind of mold this now malleable story into fitting whatever venue they happen to be in, or what makes sense for their storytelling. But I don't doubt that he did stab a Louis XIV table. I don't doubt that he said that line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great line. The story is that he stabbed this priceless table, and the hostess or the host, whoever's telling the story, it could be a man or a woman, came up to him at the end and said, "Well, now what can we tell people? You ruined our table." He says, "Well, you can tell people that Molina made that mark."
Yeah.
Right? And so Joe Hanosek, I think that's how you pronounce his name, is a magician who lives, I think, in Ohio.
Joe Hanosek.
He lives in Ohio.
Yeah.
He's here at this convention.
Yeah, I just saw him.
Oh, did you? Well, he actually owns a playing card stabbed by Molina.
Wow.
That has stab marks in it. Bam, 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 bam. Like two or three stab marks in it. That is one of a kind souvenirs of that trick. I actually have another card that Molina used. I've got many signed Molina memorabilia, but one that I really like is a playing card that was used during the card stab trick, but it wasn't stabbed. But the one that he has is a stabbed one, which is really quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
With this Max Molina book that I wrote, I was thinking it might be a fun thing, maybe for like a collector's edition, to actually have stab marks on the cover.
You'll stab each
one. I'll stab each one personally until you could tell them Cohen did it.
I love it.
Just get a machete. Smack, smack, smack.
Well, when's the book plan to come out?
Well, I've been working on it. I worked on it for a year and a half.
That's not long.
It's not long, but I've been working on it for 20 years.
Okay,
right? I modeled my career after Molina.
Sure.
And so all this time I've been doing this research, not knowing whether I would ever do anything with any of this information.
Mm-hmm.
But during the pandemic, I actually had time to sit down and write it. And I wrote like a banshee. I mean, I basically ignored all family responsibilities. And it was my morning, noon, and night therapy.
Yeah.
I did not, because, having done a magic show for 20 years and having a real rhythm to my life, it was hard to suddenly break that rhythm and not have any outlet for all my energy. So, of course,
it's kind of your hobby.
The writing became my infatuation.
Okay, passion.
And my hobby is running. So I'm a marathon runner. So I run marathons.
Hmm.
And so the running also kept me in shape. But at the same time, the magic writing for the Molina book was what kept me sane.
Yeah.
So the book should have been out by now. But we've been making all these great changes. I'll show you what the cover looks like. It took extra time to make this cover.
Yeah, send me that so I can post that.
Yeah,
too.
So it looks like, here you go. It looks like a Professor Hoffman book.
Oh, okay.
So the whole book is written as if you were reading. All the fonts are from the 19th century. The layout, everything looks like it's straight out of like a Professor Hoffman book.
And who designed the cover then?
So I found an artist. I work with Theory 11, for my playing cards, my tycoon cards. So I work with an artist who has designed cards for and back designs and box designs, tuck cases, for Theory 11. He's actually based in Russia. So this is all done digitally and remote.
That's kind of cool that you're using an old font actually for the whole book.
Yeah, the whole book. Yeah, I mean, I could show you just
On the computer that you got there?
Yeah, on my computer, I've got the entire Mellini book. You know, it's completely done and ready to go. Here's the book here. So
okay.
It's the subtitle is King of Magicians, Magician of Kings.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the layout. And as you can see, it really looks like it's from the 19th century. Like all mm-hmm. of the fonts. There's a little bit of color in the beginning, but the rest of it's all black and white. This is a painting that Ossie Wynn did of Max Mellini, which is really nice.
Beautiful.
But the entire book is, it looks as if it were straight out of, you know, the 19th century. So,
very interesting.
Yeah. But then there's a lot of tricks in here as well. So what you're seeing is just the biographical section. I went to Max Mellini's house downtown in Manhattan, Lower East Side. Like I said, I'm a runner. So what I do is I like to run around Manhattan, and I always find magic related destinations.
Yeah.
So I'll run up to 278 West 113th Street to Houdini's house.
Houdini, what's right?
Right. I'll run up there and back to my house. That's a 4 mile run, round okay. trip. Mm. I'll run from my house down to Mellini's house in the Lower East Side, and that'll give me about 12 miles round trip.
Okay.
And so, you know, I've do this in many places around the city, try to find like magic destinations, and
that's
I
funny.
Run there and back. But Mellini's house was only about 100 steps away from Professor Frank Seiden's house.
Seiden, who's that?
And Seiden, so if you take a look here, I think I passed by it. He was Mellini's magic teacher.
Oh, okay.
Right here. So this is Mellini's house.
Okay.
And about a half a block away was his magic teacher. So when he was learning magic, he actually had his mentor right there. And he's a teenager.
He could
walk back and forth, and then they mm-hmm. ended up working at a pub or a little private little saloon that Seiden owned downtown in the Lower East Side in the off the Bowery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Mellini learned how to do the cups and balls and the brick from the hat and all of his card magic.
Why was his English so bad if he grew up like?
Okay,
in
the
New
Lower
York
East,
there?
The Lower East Side was basically an immigrant community.
Where they all spoke that language.
Everyone spoke, they all spoke what we would say Jewish.
Okay.
They spoke Yiddish to each other.
Yiddish, yeah.
And you know, you could walk down the street and I've seen photos from that era and the signs are all in Hebrew.
Okay.
Or in Yiddish. Actually Yiddish, not Hebrew. People were singing, there was a big Yiddish theater you know, community down there. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it was almost like Broadway, but for the immigrants.
Hmm.
So you could go about your day and never hear a word of English.
Oh, okay.
Right? So Mellini never learned English
well. It's almost
well.
Like being brought up in a foreign country.
True, true. I mean, it's like going to Chinatown someplace. You feel like you're in another. You feel like you're in another continent.
Yeah, no vacation.
So, right. So with Mellini, he never learned English well, but then when his son spoke English well later on in life, his son said, "Pop, you've got to learn English. You've got to learn to speak English better. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll make better, have a better career."
Right.
And famously, Mellini said to his son, "If I speak English good, you don't eat."
I've never heard that one. That's a good story.
Yeah.
So again, you've got it about done. It's just a matter of
It's done. Done. I mean, the book is
it's
done.
Just getting it to the printer.
And now what we're waiting on is the printer. And, you know, we're in an unusual time in that during the pandemic, many people wrote books, right?
Because sure.
people had time. People wrote memoirs. The people wrote, you know, instructional books, things that just to kind of fill their
Okay, so publishers are backed up.
So publishers are backed up, and factories don't have paper.
Oh, I've heard this.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And so if you're a book printer and you don't have paper, now your resources are depleted.
Mm-hmm.
And also the shipping corridors between, you know, on the ocean are backed up. So everything is kind of a weird combination of events where we just can't get this book printed right away. So I wanted to have it done by this convention, by the Magi Fest.
Yeah.
Now we're looking, maybe it would be more available in December.
By Christmas.
Or hopefully by Christmas, yeah. And maybe by January.
Okay.
But, you know, it'll be soon enough. And in the big picture of life, it'll be out soon.
It'll be soon. Will Vanishing Ink be selling that? And what is the price point?
Well, it's not published by Vanishing Ink, and we haven't set a price yet.
Okay.
You know, maybe you could tell me something. You know, I'm really interested in the way that magic books are priced.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know,
I've got some suggestions we can talk about offline later.
Well, for sure. Yeah. But the reason I bring it up is, you know, like, this is not a history book, but people might think it's a history book. This is actually a magic book where it teaches, like I said, 100 really good secrets. It teaches great magic that you can actually do from a master. But people might think, oh, it's a history book, and maybe I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to spend that much. But at the same time, we have books like Johnny Thompson books, and we have, you know, Denny Haney book, and, you know, Robert Houdin books, and, and Hofstetter books, and these are priced very high.
They are.
And I'm just wondering, because we talked before about the Veblen goods, like, I'm always interested in, well, you know, how desirable does something become in the magic world if it's too pricey? I want everyone to read this. It's the same way that you know, when Harry Stanley released the original Mellini book, he said something like, or maybe Vernon said, you know, on the ad copy, I want everyone to read this because it'll benefit magicians, you know, no matter who you are. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same way with this book. I want everyone to read it because I really think it'll be eye-opening when you see how prescient Mellini was. He was just such a trailblazer. I mean, we do things today that are based on Mellini, and we still talk. I mean, the fact that we still talk about the card stab and the egg bag, and, you know, these are things that they're almost timeless, right? And he was the one who put them on the map.
Right. No, I think, I love history, and I've got many of my shelves are full of, I've got everything that Mike Caveney has put out, a lot of other things from other magicians of the past. I just think it's important to understand where we have been so we can know where we're going to be going. And but then adding magic then to it, tricks and everything is going to be in there. It has incremental value to that. And there is a certain pricing point, but there, yeah, again, talk about it then later. But you got different people of different economic backgrounds who can afford certain levels or not. And that could be that you might want to put out a collector's edition for those want to pay and can't afford a $700 book. I mean, look at, for an example, Siegfried and Roy. When they came out with their book, what was that? I think at the time it was like, was that $500?
I don't remember. I never bought that book.
When that came out, it actually came with white gloves.
Right, nice.
You would open up the box. You're supposed to put the gloves on before you take the book out and flip through the pages. I mean, as if that it is something that's precious.
Well,
and so it had, just like we've been talking about in the beginning of this, when you were saying there is an inherent value of something. And if you're putting on gloves, it's like, oh, this must be something, you know. If you kind of infuse it with that kind of value, people then were willing to pay more for something like that. Now, again, that came out, I don't know, I want to say in the late 90s or maybe it was, I want to say before 9/11 again. It seems funny how we now.
I remember when it came out.
Was it before 9/11?
Something like that.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of before.
It's been out for a while.
But $500 back then was a heck of a price for a magic book. You know, basically, about their history. But it was a beautiful color book and everything. But it's not something you're going to be leaving out on the, like, as a coffee table book. Right. Exactly.
Have you seen my coffee table book, by the way?
I have not.
Yeah, I put one out last. This is also during the pandemic. My second book that I wrote during the same time.
Is that the comic book?
No. It's after that. So this is called Confronting Magic. It came out from Asseline, which is a luxury book publisher. And the cover is silk. Okay. Wow. It's beautiful. They did such a beautiful job. The book was printed in Turkey. These are book designers on a different level. So you know how Tashin makes those beautiful books, right?
I've got a few Tashin books.
So you know the big magic book, James and the Bond circus book, and James Bond, and the Marvel comics.
They've got their own stores, Tashin.
Correct. Well, Asseline does too. So Asseline has their own stores around the world. If you're familiar with them, they're legendary. If you've never heard of them before, I could say it's like Tashin.
Okay.
But it's the book itself is a piece of art.
Okay.
But they work only with luxury brands like, you know, Ferrari and Tiffany's and, I mean, the list goes on and on, and Rolex. So they have really beautiful, beautiful books. So I was really fortunate to be able to make a book with them.
Wow.
But I said to them, look, you know, I don't want it to be unattainable. So we actually made that price point very reasonable. It's $60 a book.
Wow.
And they're sold, and I've sold thousands of them. I mean, it's incredible to me. Mm-hmm. It's, I think it's just a matter of volume. You know, the magic market is smaller, obviously.
That's true.
So
that's
We're still trying to figure out the pricing. I want to make it fair, you know, commensurate to the work that was put into it. But I also think that, you know, it deserves to be seen and read by everyone. I mean, I really hope that magicians get into this as much as I have.
I hope they do.
Because it's a, I mean, Mellini, he was, at the risk of sounding like, you know, a lot younger than I really am, he was the bomb. Like, he was really, really great. He wasn't a great man. I think he was a drunk, and he abused his wife, and, you know, and I write about all that stuff in the book too. So maybe he wasn't the greatest guy, but he was, I think, a great magician.
Yeah.
Really great magician.
Well, I think you're a really great magician also, and I applaud you for all that you have done for magic and taking it to this level. And this is the kind of thing that puts magic in the right light. It needs to be as a performing art and being recognized among those who are at levels who can hire other magicians and trying to keep our goal as non-Steve Cohen people, the rest of the magic fraternity should try to be at your level to perform magic in as good a way as you can. You were talking about how important it is when people come to see your show that you deliver what it is. I remember when I was working the Magic Castle one time in the close-up room, and a couple came in who were from England. And this man and his wife said, "We are pensioners," which they're retired, meaning this is the first time we've come to the United States. We'd saved all our money. This was not just a bucket list. This was our life goal. This is the one and only time we're coming to the United States, and the Magic Castle was our destination. We've talked for 40 years about coming here. And I think there's a little bit of pressure on me. It's like, better deliver a good show. And so I started thinking about that. Every show should be as if that person is in my audience.
Sure, absolutely. You know? That's a good way to put it. I mean, the way I like to think of it is, you know, people have the option to go to any other experience in New York City right now.
Yeah.
They could have gone to the opera. They could have gone to Carnegie Hall. They could have gone to Madison Square Garden. They could have gone to, you know, any number of countless number of Broadway shows, et cetera. But they chose to spend their time, their money, and their energy with me. Yeah. So I have a great obligation to deliver something extraordinary for them.
You do.
And, you know, it takes a lot of guts to put your shingle out and in a town like New York and say, I feel like I've got something which is worth your attention. So you do have to back it up. You have to be exceptional. And a way I like to think of it is what Michael Jordan said, if you ever saw that documentary series that came out earlier this year, and he said something like, you know, I have to always be at my best at all times, at all times, every time.
Yeah.
So it's not just like once in a while you do a great show. It has to be consistent. And in a way, you know, that's putting a lot of pressure on you. That's why I run. My running is my release. Because I really put a lot of pressure on myself to give my all.
Well, that being his Michael Jordan's motto and everything, and we've been talking about over the last period of time here about a variety of things. And so as I close over here, of course, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And so I always like to close by asking my guests, what is it that's your philosophy of life? Like, what is your word or words or phrase? Or
yeah, I don't necessarily have a phrase.
What's important to you?
But I would say that there's a great expression that I learned from my mentor, who's a poetry professor. And she said, don't push the river. You have to let it flow. And what that means is we all want success and we all want to see results right away.
Sure.
You started a show, for example, you started a new venture, anything. You want to know that all the effort and time you put into something would give you some tangible results. But you have to live it. You have to let it live in its own real time. And that's the other second half of this, is to live in real time and expect things to happen in real time as opposed to your desired time frame. So you can't push the river. You have to let it flow. And once you accept that, then it's kind of very Buddhist in a way, right? It's very accepting. Acceptance of time as an element. And you know, I always wanted to make the show run for 20 years. So if I had stumbling blocks along the way, if there was a problem, if there was an issue or if I had a bad show, that was like a pebble on the beach for me. So I expected that to happen because I knew that I'm looking in the long term.
Yeah.
So I would say that don't push the river. You have to let it flow.
Love it. Steve, thanks very much. Enjoyed our time together. We don't get together often enough, but different parts of the world here. So I'm glad we had this time.
Same here. Thanks so much for
Thanks again. Thanks. So with the Magic Word Podcast, that was Steve Cohen. This is Scotty out.
Thank you, Steve, for your time and your words and your friendship. That was really great. I appreciate the length of time we had to share this time together in our conversation, and I hope you listeners were enjoying that, even though we had to split that up into a couple of episodes. I've done that because I've had requests in the past. Sometimes my episodes used to be way too long. And again, of course, podcasts can be as long as they need to be, and people can turn them off and start them up whenever they want, but I like to have something that can be in kind of chunks of time that are easily digestible, so when people are out for a walk with their dog, or they're in the gym, or they are in drive time to and from work or something in rush hour, they are something that they can kind of focus on just for that time. So that's why I've split this up into two episodes, and it's not unprecedented. We've done that with several others, with David Berglis and Paul Daniels and Garrett Thomas, just to name a few, and Brad Henderson. Anyhow, so thank you again very much for coming back and for listening to this second episode, second part, I should say, of this. And I might also say that whenever we were finished with our conversation and the microphones were turned off, Steve was showing me the tea kettle that he had acquired that used to belong to David Devant. Yes, a David Devant from England, who was an early member of the Magic Circle. And there is the David Devant Award. Anyhow, it was phenomenal. There are some pictures, if you'll go to the Magic Word podcast.com, of the tea kettle, and also the custom-made carrying case that David Devant had made for the tea kettle. Although it's functional, he would not use it because of, I don't want to give away too much of the secrets, but there's some things, I guess, about the tea kettle that are really more for observational purposes. It's just kind of a cool thing to have that is a piece, an iconic piece of our magical history. By the way, one of the things that Steve and I were talking about when we were discussing the Max Molini book was I had requested that he send me a copy of the cover of the book, which he has not sent to me because it is still at the printer and maybe subject to some sort of last-minute changes. Anyhow, I did not get a copy of that because of those reasons. So therefore, it is not on the website. So when you go to the magicwordpodcast.com, you'll see some other interesting pictures and some videos as well, but not a photo of the cover for the upcoming book. So again, I suggest you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, this week's episode number 651, and there you'll see several photos as well as some links to videos as well that talks a little bit about Max Molini, but also will show some of the pictures about the tea kettle, which we didn't get into during this conversation. But that is also, of course, one of the Think-A-Drink is one of the signature pieces in Steve Cohen's regular show there at the Chamber Magic Show in the Palace Hotel. Well, I want to remind everybody again, if you would, make sure you subscribe to our weekly pod letter, so this way that you get notification as to who's going to be on from week to week, and then also who's going to be coming up next week. I will tell you in advance right now, since next Thursday is going to be Thanksgiving in the United States, and it is a legal holiday, and a lot of people are traveling and spending time watching football or having turkey and spending time with friends and family. I thought it probably would be best if we not have an episode next Thursday and just kind of let you digest your meal and also your time together and giving thanks. And if you do want to go back and have a podcast fix and you're jonesing just a little bit for wanting to make sure you can listen to one of the episodes of the Magic Word Podcast, there are over 650 episodes now that are in the can that you can go back and find in the archives, or you can just do a search on the website. There's a handy little search bar there on the magicwordpodcast.com website. And you just type in any magician's name, pretty much just about anybody, or a magic subject or something, and you might find just a plethora of information that is of interest that you can listen to and perhaps you hadn't heard before, or go back and listen to again. I know that you will enjoy it. So again, next week on November 25th, there will not be an episode, but we'll return then again in early December and pick up where we left off then with episode number 652. So if you subscribe to the pod letter, you will know who's going to be upcoming in that episode. I also would like to request gently, if you would make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Texas Magician. And also you'd do us a huge favor if you could just give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you use to listen
to these episodes, whether it happens to be through Google Play or through iTunes or whatever. I'm sure there is a way where you can go in and give us a rating and just leave us a few comments as to what it is you like about the podcast, and maybe even a suggestion to what episode or episodes you've enjoyed best, so that way others can listen and read your comments and be directed to those episodes then as well. And they might get hooked because of your suggestions. And I would certainly appreciate that. And it helps the podcast grow. I can't explain just how great that really is. As far as how the analytics work, I don't know for iTunes and all that, but your help will be appreciated. Well, that's enough for me. And I appreciate you coming back and listening here this week. And so until next week, or I guess I should say until December 2nd, our next episode, stay well, get booked, and remember, strive for perfection every time. And also, as Steve says, don't push the river. You have to let it flow. Think about that. That's really cool. This is Scotty out.